Hey everybody, and welcome to Declutter Me, a podcast about organizing and decluttering your life. And hello to your host, Shalina.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good today. So what do we have for our listeners?
Today, we're sharing our chat with Dr. Saliha Afridi, who is the co-founder of Lighthouse Arabia, the leading mental health and wellness clinic in the UAE, providing psychological and psychiatric care.
And we'd like to let you know as well that we're going to do this in two parts. So today we're airing the first part of Shalina's chat with Dr. Saliha.
Okay, so the Lighthouse was founded 9 years ago by Dr. Saliha Afridi and Dr. Tara Wine. They were already working in a previous clinic, but Dr. Saliha kept feeling like she wasn't doing enough at the time.
I really felt like a big part of me just was not being given expression, and I really listened to that voice inside of me that something's not right, you need to like go do something about this. And so after doing some introspection and reflection, I realized that it was the part that actually was quite connected to the community.
Right.
I love what I do. I love my one-on-one clients. We do magic together. But I think being outside in the community is something that is just very, very important to me. Yeah, so I started interviewing in all sorts of places that might give me that sort of opportunity, but there was always some sort of red tape or yellow tape or blue tape, some tape where they said that it just wasn't going to happen in the way I wanted it to happen. And so actually it was one man that I met at a personal dinner party, and he said he wanted to know about grief. And I said, okay, well, it's not really a dinner party conversation, it's not very light-hearted. But we spoke a little bit about grief and death and bereavement and mourning. And then we decided to meet up outside of that.
Right.
And I found myself really coming to life when I was doing that work. We spent about 7 hours within the next couple of weeks talking about this topic. And then he said, this is great. Now I want you to go and tell this other group of people that have all experienced a loss.
Right.
And then I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I spoke to them about the same things, grief, death, dying. And, you know, it was just a very, very emotional session.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people had experienced a death maybe years ago. And this particular man who had asked me to do this, he had actually, his relationship, his partner, his fiance, I think, that relationship had actually dissolved as a result of him not being able to support her as she experienced the death of her mother. So he was just kind of like, okay, come on, let's get on with it. And so he said, I couldn't save my relationship. So there were two deaths that happened as a result of that. And then he said, so now I want you to go out and do this for the rest of the community, because this is how the six people don't know what to do with mental health. What can you do for the rest? And eventually, after doing a lot of research, flying to the U.S., learning about grief, I came back and I gave them these opportunities where I said I could continue to work in the clinic that I was working in.
But
cost effective, not so much. Hospitals, again, cost effective, not so much. Or what I could do is I could take the money that they were going to give me. Mm. I would ask them to give me 3 years up front.
Right.
So maybe take a chance on me. They didn't really know me very well.
Yeah.
But I said, but I would start a private practice. And in that private practice, we would have grief services for as long as the private practice was around.
Right.
We would not charge the community. We would do free grief consults, which is a 1 hour session with anyone who's experienced a loss, to teach them how to go through the grief process.
Yeah.
We would have support groups for children, adults, women, people who've survived, those who have committed suicide, miscarriages. They love this idea because they were like, okay, well, we only have to make a 3 year investment for almost like a whatever lifetime return. And that's where I got the seed money for the Lighthouse.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, because I see that you have workshops. So you have...
Well, those are support groups.
Right, okay.
And we have them twice a month. And they've been going on now for 9 years since the day we opened. I remember the first one we had, it was one person. And we still did it because it was just our commitment. And now we have... they started offshooting into several different kinds of groups. Now we have a motherless daughters one... general support group, people who've lost a child. So we've sort of branched out as we saw the need get bigger. But yeah, we're the only one in the region, if I can say, the Middle East and Asia, the only grief support group that is coming out of the US Dougie Center model, which is considered the mothership of grief centers.
Because I do have a lot of clients that accumulate clutter because of grief. So they don't process the grief properly. And by the time they call me, it's a year later or 2 years later. And they've suffered for so long, don't know how to talk to anyone. And I think it's a cultural thing as well. You have the 3 months to grieve or 40 days to grieve, and that's it. You have to get on with life. And it's not that easy. And so they start doing other things like shopping, or traveling and shopping as well. And don't clear out their house because they don't know, or they don't want to. They've got other things on their head, in their mind. And you feel it when, you know, once we've finished the decluttering process, you feel that and see that weight going off them. But it's getting them to say, okay, that weight's gone. Now we need to sort out the mind. And that's my, you know, there's only so much I can do. You know, they have to do it themselves. I always say, how do the clients come? When do they come? Do they come straight away or does it take time?
Yeah, you know? there's people that have come the minute they find out, they make a phone call and then we have a one-on-one session with them. There are times when really they call us in a state of crisis. And then there are people that come 5 years later. It just depends on how that person processes their grief, how much space they have, how much emotional capacity they have at that time, as well as resilience. Because you don't want to go deep sea diving when you can't, you know, you don't have any space in your life for like even a breath of air. So this, you really have to build a muscle sometimes internally to approach something like this.
And another thing that comes up with when I declutter is divorce. So, you know, that's another mental health issue that arises as well. How do you, you know, what about when they come to see you and when do they come to see you as well? Because I find as some of them, they do it when they're moving out of the house. So the wives will call me and say, can you help? Because I can't handle, I've had to deal with this divorce. I'm leaving the house or moving. Can you organize everything?
Yeah, that really just depends on where they're at. I think a lot of times what I have noticed that when people are in crisis, they are just getting through it. They're in this fight or flight mode. They don't have time to sit back and process what's happening. Mm-hmm. Yep. So they might come to you and say, I don't even know what's in here, just get rid of it, yep, or help me sort through it. But only when that fight and flight mode has sort of come down and they've moved into their new house and they've settled down, that's when they might actually sort of crash emotionally.
Yep.
And that might take 6 months for people. It might take a year for some people.
Right. Yeah.
So it just depends on how the person processes emotions,
yeah,
and how resilient they are. The longer the fight and flight can hold on, because there are some people that are just tough.
Yeah.
They're going to tough it out, and they just tough it out. And then eventually they might have some sort of thing happen, maybe in a future relationship.
Yeah.
They might start, you know, 3 years later, they might be in another relationship, and that's when they might come to us and say, whoa, I just realized I got baggage.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yes,
like,
yes,
emotional baggage and probably other kind
get
of baggage,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's when we sort through their emotional baggage then.
Yeah. And how do you deal with it? Is that more a one-to-one thing or do you have like a group thing?
Yeah,
for these?
That's usually one-to-one.
Right.
We don't have any groups for divorce as of yet. The only groups that we have are for depression,
right,
and just how do you manage coping skills and anxiety. How do you manage coping skills? We don't have any process groups as of yet,
right,
for such things.
Things, yeah. I mean, yeah, I suppose that is a very personal thing,
yeah,
as well, and each person has their own thing.
And well, in the US and, you know, in other parts of the world, they do have such things, but in Dubai, there's still, like, you know, there's like 1 degree of separation. If we sit here for maybe 2 more minutes, we probably will know someone who knows someone. And then you don't feel safe to talk about your stuff. So
yeah,
that's why people prefer one-to-one.
One of the things she brought up as well is how we're at a hyperactive age and it's coming with various cons, including people self-diagnosing, especially on Google, which can be very dangerous.
I've definitely seen that there's more awareness. There's definitely a lot of, I don't know what the word is. The word is flying out of my head, but the word would be like misinformation. this stuff, because people are just going to Dr. Google and everyone has like 3 personality disorders and God knows how many mood disorders, and that's what they figured out online. There's a lot of people like catastrophizing and freaking out because they think they have borderline personality, which is like a really tough diagnosis, like, or they think they're bipolar because they're moody, you know, so just information in the wrong hands can sometimes be even more dangerous. Actually, no, it's very often more dangerous. So yes, there's definitely more information. There's more awareness. But I actually think that we've reached a breaking point. I actually don't think that all of a sudden there's less stigma. And so, look, now everyone is calling us and everyone wants to see us. I think the stigma is very much there. It's just that people can't take it anymore. And they're drowning at this point. And so there was a buildup that led to this place. And I can say that this year, since September, the Lighthouse has never been bigger and it's never been busier than it has. And we cannot hire people fast enough. We're doing all sorts of low-cost group initiatives just as like a holding pattern and teaching people skills, because until we get to see you one-on-one, which may not be for a while, like, let's give you something so you are not drowning out there. So we're giving them some skills, but I've never seen it this bad. And that could be, one, there's more awareness. Two, there's a lot of information, sort of catastrophic thinking. And then three, breaking point, because we've consumed it all. We've consumed our well-being. And I remember one time I went to a Chinese doctor and I was like, oh, I'm fine and I'm great. And this was before I burned out. And I was like, no, this is good. I'll sleep when I'm dead, kind of thinking. And she said, you're borrowing from the future. Right. And when you get to the future, there will be nothing there.
Yeah.
And I eventually got to that future where I had consumed all the energy and the mental space and the money and the environment. And we're going to get to a place where we don't have anything left.
Yeah.
And we'll have a lot of stuff, but we'll be like buried under that stuff.
So I was a bit surprised that she thought this, that we're not necessarily past the stigma, but that things have actually just gone out of hand. And that's why we're forced to act.
Yeah, but I see this with my clients as well, as there's more awareness about decluttering. But, you know, they've accumulated it for so many years that now it's got to that crunch point that they have to finally deal with it. And it's the same with the mental health issue. Due to the consumerism from the 80s moving upwards, you know, and having more stuff and having the digital life, you know, etc. It's all been building up and brewing and brewing and brewing. And now we're at that tipping point in 2020.
Now, one of the things that strikes me while I'm listening to this is the awareness aspect of it. So I think as we've talked about as well, you know, most people are still stuck between the stigma of admitting that they have a problem and then perhaps not understanding the kind of problem they have.
Yes, the issues manifest themselves through clutter or hoarding. So while we might solve the symptoms, it takes a bit of work to then solve the underlying issue. Dr. Sliha told us about the mental health first aid program they're running to try and help demystify some of the myths around mental health. So think of it like physical first aid as well. It's about training people to help others with identifying mental health issues and then pointing them in the right direction for help.
So we have mental health first aid. We are the only clinic licensed in the UAE, actually possibly the region at this point, that actually brought this the international program from Australia, which is in 23 countries, heavy funding from the UK and the US government within their, you know, countries to train people in mental health first aid. And mental health first aid is similar to physical health first aid. However, you can do it on yourself as well with mental health first aid. And it's a 12-hour course. There's one that is 14 hours. And then there's one that is 5 hours. So the 12-hour course is an adult-to-adult mental health first aid where we take you through the major diagnoses like depression, anxiety, suicidality, substance abuse, psychosis, etc. And we take you through all of that. We do role plays that if you see something like this, what would you do? We demystify a lot of things. People are, oh my God, I didn't realize I was, you know, anxious my whole life and I can now do something about it. So we are building awareness on that front. So that might have had something to do with some of this uptake as well. So one is adult to adult, one is adult to adolescent, and one is adolescent to adolescent. So they're not going to Dr. Google and self-diagnosing and misdiagnosing. So we've done a lot. Actually, we had our first one in Bahrain this weekend, where people flew in and we trained people in MHFA. So that's one thing that we're doing on the mental health awareness front. But we have spent thousands of hours within schools and in companies, within government organizations, community centers, even community gatherings, where we talk about mental health, wellness, well-being, and parenting. I believe that if we can talk to our parents, that we can at least protect that generation that is coming up. One out of six, although I bet that number is a lot higher in Dubai, one out of six kids 8 to 18 is struggling with some sort of mental health issue. And 50% of those will come by the age of 14. For them, consumerism is just a thing. This is just what you do. There's no relationship to anything because everything has been so devalued by social media. And that's the world. And this is their identity. This is who they are. This is how they feel they exist. And so the whole cyberbullying or the whole bullying thing that happened, I don't want to blame the girl or shame the girl. I know that I also had been bullied when I was younger, but it doesn't help anyone when we just ostracize one person and say she's wrong. It's the whole community that is dropping the ball here, because if we are not focused on kindness and generosity, if we're not doing these kinds of things, which is what we do when we go out and we do these talks, they're all usually 60 to 90 minutes long. Everyone that works at the Lighthouse has to make a commitment that they will be doing these kinds of things free of charge for the community. We've done thousands of them up to this point. A lot of times people think that when you're a psychologist, you must have it all together. And it's like, yeah, no. We suffer and we struggle and we go out and buy things just to make ourselves feel better. And then we feel like really bad because we shouldn't have done that. And so there's all kinds of, we are human. And so I think wanting to bring that onto social media was also one of my agendas. I'm a mother of four children. And let me tell you all the ways that I mess up every single day and hope that tomorrow will be a better day. And it's just a constant struggle. And, you know, my own decluttering journey. And I remember that there are times where I go through these periods where I want to just go out and just throw everything out. Mm. I feel overwhelmed by my life and I just want to take everything and chuck it, you know. Yeah. And then one time I was doing this and I noticed that this feeling, I'm like, this is an interesting feeling that I haven't actually made contact with before, and there was so much shame.
Right. Okay.
And I don't think people think about clutter and anxiety, but people do not think about clutter and shame.
So what was your shame? Where
my shame was, you didn't think before you bought this thing.
Oh wow.
You didn't think, did you need this? You didn't think that, maybe I should go home and check if I have 17 pairs of blue pants or black shoes or whatever. Like, you didn't do that. You just were impulsive. You didn't think through this. You wasted money. Then it hung in your closet because it's just not something you gravitated towards, or it was just an impulsive buy. And so there was so much shame. So then I had to sit through and go through the process of just forgive yourself and what is the lesson here and how can you make sure you don't do that again? So there was a lot of self-compassion that I had to exercise, but I can tell you that there was not anxiety. I was not holding on to that stuff because I was anxious. I was holding on to that stuff because I felt guilty, and under that guilt laid an iceberg of shame that I just didn't want to deal with.
Wow, that's a big thing though, because as you know, as you said, and as I say, you're human. We all have our moments. I buy things. I will get slightly shamed by a Chirag when I do buy things. But you're human. Things happen.
And a lot of us have actually been raised by parents who valued the stuff they had.
Yeah.
They had two bags, and then they wore those bags.
Yes.
And then when they could no longer wear them, and actually, they kept them so neatly that I could still wear those bags. Like, they took care of their things.
Yes.
And then this is my DNA.
Yeah.
And so when I'm not doing that, there's shame there.
Yeah.
Like, you have no regard for money. You have no regard for things. You have no regard. Whew. That's why I was like, I'll declutter later, because I don't want to actually deal with the shame. But that's a huge one, actually.
But that's a generation thing as well. I mean, yeah, our parents are around most probably the same age. And I don't tell my parents when I buy things because I know they will shame me all the way back in the UK.
Exactly.
And it shouldn't
what
be like
what did you need this for? You didn't need this. Save it for yourself. Save it for retirement. Like, So, yeah. It's still something. I cannot say that I'm beyond it and I'm past it. There's still so many things that I could probably not have in my home and I could probably not be buying. But outside clutter is inside baggage.
Exactly. And it affects your gut as well. But then what did you do? You said that you didn't declutter that time because you were dealing with the shame. When
did
you?
Just too much. But then I've done it. Right. And then I do it again. And then I do it again. And then I do it again. And so I'm constantly, there's one thing I cannot, and I don't care what declutter person comes and tells me to, is like, get rid of your books. I'm not going to do it. Leave me to my books. Yeah. Me and my books we have a relationship. So I can't, and my daughter can't, and we really just get rid of everything. Here's my diamond. Take it. But I cannot get rid of my books. Like, I really feel I'm getting, it's like a photograph for me. It's like a time for me. I can get rid of photographs, no problem, but I cannot get rid of my books.
Books, books are an issue with lots of my clients. I'm a book person. I love books growing up. I work for a book club company, but yeah, I will get, like, I have thousands of books.
So it's actually like a scrap book for me here of like my memories, but maybe one day, but I've done a lot. And I was actually just thinking, because I was thinking about this talk that we were going to have today, and I was thinking that, you know, there's so much stuff in my closet that I need to get rid of. I just need to get rid of it, really. Yeah. And then I thought, you know, next time, I think one way people can avoid buying more things is to spend 1 hour before they go out going through their closet.
Yeah.
Because once they're reminded about all the stuff they have, nope, you're not going to buy anymore because it's overwhelming. And you're like, oh my God, what was I thinking? So you're less likely to be all excited about buying things. So this is going to be another thing that I'm going to do now.
Okay, so that's all we have for you for this week. As we mentioned already, we'll be airing a second part of this chat with Dr. Saliha next week.
Yeah, and next week it'll be all about social media and mental addiction around it, so stay tuned for that.
As always, you can find all of our episodes for free in your favorite podcast players. That's Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Gami, and anywhere else you might be listening, as well as on the website, declutterme.com/podcast.